Well, welcome to the Being Catholic Weekly podcast. I have the great pleasure this week of speaking with Dan Burke, who is at the moment doing some fantastic work with EWTN and also the National Catholic Register. Now, EWTN, I still think, is the largest Catholic media organisation in the world, and Dan could probably clarify that for me in a moment. But Dan's doing some really interesting work, and I came across his work through a piece that he'd written on Catholic education, and I thought it'd be great to talk to. So, Dan, welcome aboard.
It's great to be with you, Jonathan.
It's I just was talking to Dan a moment ago. It's 8 o'clock here in the morning, and where are you based at the moment, Dan? Where what city are you in?
I'm in Birmingham, Alabama.
The Masters is not too far away from you, is it? It's about 2 weeks away. How far from Augusta are you?
Oh, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, okay. Depending on whether you follow the speed limit or not.
Okay, a little closer than I am anyway.
Yeah.
So look, tell us, I've had the pleasure of looking at a lot of what you've been doing, and let's begin just talking a little bit about your journey. You've got a fantastic story, and I'm going to share the YouTube interview you did about your journey into the Catholic faith, but give us a few high points about that journey that you've taken.
Well, I was born in into a Jewish faith and experienced what many would call, I think, a great deal of suffering as a child, loss, physical illness, abuse. And through the struggle with suffering came to the reality embarked on a search, which eventually led me to embrace Christ as my Messiah. I became a good Southern Baptist. But even there, I felt some dissonance in my soul with respect to my faith and what was the church and what was truth and how might you understand how to interpret scripture. And, you know, of course, there's so many different denominations and perspectives. So I am a voracious reader. So I began reading in church history, ended up landing in the middle of the Apostolic Fathers, which are those writers who wrote within the time that the New Testament was being written. So Clement of Rome, Irenaeus of Lyons, Shepherd of Hermas, those types of documents. And really just eventually came to believe that the Catholic Church was the fullest expression of God's work here on earth, the most accurate, the most complete. Certainly I'm not eliminating the faith of our Protestant brothers and sisters or our more near brothers and sisters in the East, but the Catholic faith is the most complete expression of God's will on earth. And so I submitted to that reality in 2005, and I was received into the church.
It must have been an incredible, like, interior journey, because to move from the Judaism of your youth would have been an extraordinary thing in itself. I mean, are we talking Dark Night of the Soul, you know, Jacob wrestling with the angel? Tell us a bit about that interior process.
Well, I mean, there was a great deal of suffering for most of my life, physical illness as well, that helped to propel me into reflection on ultimate issues. But it was actually a lot easier to go from Judaism to Christianity than it was to go from Protestantism to Catholicism. Yeah. The struggle my stepfather, the first Catholic I ever met was my stepfather, who beat my mother, fired a gun in our home in a fight, destroyed our home end to end. He tried to convince me the Catholic faith was the one true faith. So as you might imagine, that in and of itself made the journey far more difficult. I had a great deal of intellectual challenge, heart challenge to overcome on top of the intellectual challenge. So, certainly the dark night in its truest sense, I think I have experienced.
Well, I'm basically going to throw out every interview question I had now, because I love these interviews. They just take a direction of their own. And I really felt moved to pick up on something. The concept of suffering, and you've made a couple of mentions to that journey of suffering in your own life. And I've been arguing for a long time that culturally we have no idea what to do with suffering. So a secular materialist culture is going to ameliorate, drug, deny any form of human suffering. And listening to what you've said and also reading Michael O'Brien's very moving novel, A Father's Tale.
Amazing book.
Isn't it? Isn't it? Such an incredible novel. And the essence of suffering at the peak moment of that book, when he is being actually tortured and he encounters the
Christ.
Yeah, in that. So talk a bit about that. I mean, culturally we want to deny suffering, but you found something through and on the other side of it.
Well, as a teen, I, at about 18 years old, I had determined that if my life was going to continue according to the trend of the prior 18 years, that I had no interest in participating, because I couldn't. I had come to a conclusion that seems elusive to many. But why would you endure this much suffering? Why would you endure the emotional abuse, the physical situation in my home, the loss of my family members later on even? Why would you endure all of that? And frankly, the only reason that I could live with was that my suffering has a purpose, and that is to prepare me to meet face to face with the King of Kings. It has a purgative or a cleansing intent, whereby God helps us to clean out the original sin, the darkness in our soul, to prepare us to live with Him in eternity in joy and without tears, without sadness. And with that understanding that all I had been through and all that I might go through then moving forward had meaning, that gave me sufficient hope to live and to live, I would call an incredibly joyous, glorious, hopeful life.
It's profoundly countercultural, just hearing you talk about it, but it's setting off so many things. Just in me, I remember being a young guy back in 1994, and I spent a year in Europe, and I got off the plane, and I was on the other side of the world in this remote place where I was going to be there for 12 months, and the homesickness and the loneliness, and here I was in this vast, I was at boarding school in a very remote area, nobody was there for another 2 weeks, and I can look back after almost 20 years and say that those days of profound disconnection and loneliness were some of the, probably some of the most profound connections I've had with the passion and with Christ through suffering. So I think what you're saying there, I'm so excited people are going to hear it, because I think they're going to need to sit with that. And it's so countercultural to talk about suffering. And something else you said, talking about your stepfather, how did you come to God as Father, and what's that experience like for you now, when your archetype of fatherhood was so traumatic? What's that journey been like?
That's a great question. I think I've had a problem both on father and mother. My biological father is a much more reasonable, kind, fair man. So I didn't have this total absence of a legitimate role model like some do. So though he's agnostic and on the faith side, he's been really silent or dismissive, but not negative, but dismissive at times. But so he provided me with a sense of God as provider, God as being on my side. But the harder one was actually my mother, and it was really rebuilding a place where I could look. I mean, Mary has become my ultimate perfect mother, who will always treat me the way I should be treated, always protect me, always never allow me to be in a situation that wouldn't be for my greatest good. My relationship with Mary has actually been more redemptive in that rebuilding sense of my parents' role in understanding God's economy.
It's we talk about the Catholic Church being a mansion or a house with many rooms, and often feel that educators kind of don't realize that with all the damage in our lives, there's so many compartments and rooms to walk into to encounter healing.
No doubt. You, the analogy you're using, St. Teresa of Avila used in the interior castles, and as you described your time alone and we talk about suffering, to me, Teresa talks about entering into the interior life. There are two things that must be present. One is an active life of prayer, and two is reflection. And then she goes on in the first few mansions to reveal self-awareness in the context of God, or Godward self-awareness, is liberating because we understand who we truly are, who God is, and then what he's done for us. The suffering that we're talking about can, if we embrace it, and if we look to God to help us understand it, can bring a self-revelation and an awareness of God in ways that no other experience in life can bring. And that's why, when you talked about the Dark Night, the teachings of John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, why those periods are so critical to our spiritual growth. But we must embrace them. We must lean in to the pain rather than running from it, inebriating, as you've alluded to, with respect to how our culture deals with pain. If we can lean in, when we do, like in the Father's Tale, we will encounter Christ in places we never thought possible, and we will find healing and joy and peace in ways that we never thought possible.
It's beautiful to listen to you, and it's hard though, isn't it? I think of Jesus teaching about the Eucharist. I've been watching Robert Barron's series and his chapter on the Eucharist. You know, when Jesus talks about, you know, unless you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink of his blood, you cannot have eternal life, and how intolerable that teaching was. And, you know, he turns and says to the disciples, do you want to leave me as well? And hearing you talk about suffering is so similar. It's the culture that just doesn't want to know. And how do we do that? How do we take the richness of what you're talking about there and communicate that to Catholic educators, you know, to students? Because, you know, even in our own faith, not many people want to go there. How do we do it? How do we share that richness?
Well, I think the first part, the first place to stop, or the first place to start, is we must begin with a living relationship with Christ in prayer, actively participating in the sacraments, pursuing prayer as revealed to us in our beautiful tradition of union with God. At whatever degree we begin to the height of contemplation that God has prepared for each of us in this life, that universal call to holiness. But if we can get our arms around this idea that Jonathan, before the beginning of time, God saw you and decided that he wanted to spend eternity with you. And in order to do that, there were things that had to occur, which included the brokenness of man, the brokenness of Jonathan, the restoration of the cross, and the resurrection. If we can enter in, even in little ways, into that mystery to where Christ becomes real to us, that's the beginning place. From there, there's a whole journey that unfolds with respect to gaining unique insight into the mystery of our own, his plan for us in specific. But it's very different for each person, the degree of suffering we can entertain, the degree of understanding we can gain, at what pace. It's all about that interior life and living with in a love relationship with Christ.
Which is about, as you said, making time for prayer and time for the sacraments, which is kind of a mantra I've been really trying to share with Catholic educators, because I think our schools are only going to be a reflection of the interior life of the people in them and leading them.
No doubt. And look, if we're going to educate kids and teach them arithmetic and English and mathematics and history and all of these different things, and so we're going to enlighten their minds, let's say, what good is that if they end up in hell? We must introduce them to Christ and equip them for dealing with this life effectively. But that begins with an introduction to Christ. Otherwise, we're wasting our time. We might as well go make more money in another kind of school system, and pretend and live our lives, of course, until judgment, when it all becomes unraveled. But why waste your time in Catholic education if you're not going to bring people to the ultimate reality that that education was designed to reveal?
It's interesting listening to your Christology. This constant reference to Christ. I've got a speaking engagement in a few weeks and working with a couple of schools, and I keep thinking of the opening line. I think it's from Redemptor Hominis, where the encyclicals are so powerful and so hidden, we don't access them enough. But the opening line is where John Paul just says one sentence. He just says, "Jesus Christ is the center of the universe and of history." And
right.
And the raw power of that line, and all the reading that I've done over the years, and the encyclicals on Catholic education, it's all pointing there, isn't it? We can build so much on the periphery, but can you take us to that central point? Tell us about the centrality of Christ.
Well, I mean, it begins in John. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was made flesh, and he dwelt among us. You know, everything begins and ends with Christ. And if we don't get that right, there's this, you reminded me of the passage in Colossians where it describes how Christ holds all things together. It says in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." You know, I could continue reading, but the point is that there isn't anything that can be understood about our world, about each of us as persons, about how we educate, about how we live as fathers and mothers and siblings and parents, that doesn't have Christ at its center. And in any of those disciplines, or any of those duties or those roles that we have, if in any way you remove Christ out of the center, Christ is what holds it all together. If you remove him, all of it unravels and becomes for nothing. So Christ must be at the center of everything that we do, everything that we think. We must bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, as Paul says. We must be transformed by our living relationship with him, or none of it means anything.
All right, well, what I'm going to do, you've had a free ride so far, so now I'm going to give you a tougher question. So,
okay.
Basically, it's this. I want you to think about the several thousand Catholic educators and principals and people that will listen to this. Let's talk about how we do this. I mean, I've been lucky enough to have a pretty strong formation, and even with a tribe of very young children, I still fight very hard for personal prayer and a sacramental life. But that's not the experience of everybody listening. So give us a how. I mean, I am moved listening to you, but for those people listening, how can they begin the first steps towards a deeper encounter with Christ? What do they need to do?
Very simply, what I would do is remember back to St. Teresa of Avila. Entering in to this beautiful journey with God begins with two things. One is prayer, and the other is self-reflection. So begin by, for instance, setting aside 5 minutes a day. If you don't have a regular prayer life, if you set aside 5 minutes, which you might think is minuscule or weak or insignificant, I can tell you that the whole of heaven will rejoice when you begin to do that. Every day, meet Christ, give him a few minutes, talk to him about what you plan to do that day, ask him to help you, ask him to be present with you, and then over time, and read some books about prayer. Pick up my book, Navigating the Interior Life, or a book by Jacques Philippe called Time for God. Begin to read about prayer, or the fourth section of the Catechism on Christian Prayer. Try to get your mind and heart wrapped around this idea that God is not just a principle or a philosophy, but he is a real and living person that desires to have a relationship with you, that, and this is the purpose for your existence. It is the central purpose. So begin that prayer, redouble your commitment to the sacraments, get to confession, every other week at minimum. Why? Because that's the self-reflection part. What you're doing when you go to confession is you're examining your life and the way you're living and putting that in contrast with God's plan for you, his plan of love for you. That will begin to help you to understand where you really stand with God. Those activities, coupled with Mass every Sunday at least, that will begin to transform your life if you engage it with a disposition saying, okay, I'm not God, you are, help me, show me yourself. In John chapter 14, Jesus promises that if you live in a covenant of love with him, he will reveal himself to you. He didn't, and he said, the Father and I will come and abide with you. I will reveal myself to you. So those are tangible promises. So he's either a liar, or he really meant what he said, and he really will do what he does, what he promises. But the key is you must engage with him. You can have a relationship with no one by turning your back to them. You must look face to face, eye to eye with anyone you desire to love and whom you desire to love you, and you must engage with them. So that's the practical way, is getting on a daily, beginning with daily prayer and engaging with sacraments. Those are the steps that are going to take you out of a shallow Christianity, not even worse than that, and get you into something that's meaningful, dynamic, and life-changing.
It's just amazing to listen to you, and I think listening to you talk there about those practical steps, I'm reminded of the Latin Caepax Dei, which I've often shared with teachers. You know, the Caepax Dei, for those not familiar, is that which has the capacity for God. We are fundamentally God-seeking things. And, you know, it's almost an anachronism sometimes in Catholic circles to say that we have a God-shaped hole at the center of our existence, and we've become cultural specialists at filling it with just about everything else.
But what happens, you know what happens when you do that. People have an emptiness. People listening to us are going to listen and say, Jonathan's got something I don't have. I want that. I want that peace. I want that purpose. Well, that desire is actually God speaking to you right now if you're listening to that. And so Hebrews says, today if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. Turn to him. If you don't know how, he will show you how. The church has the answers. You'll find them.
And it's not just our movement towards God, is that it's, as you've just said there, it's the movement of God endlessly towards us. And maybe people listening, if they do get that 5 minutes, could take some time to read something like The Prodigal Son, which, you know, is I heard a great homily last weekend where, you know, the fact even that the father sort of walked out onto the highway to look for the son would have been profoundly scandalous for Hebrews at that time. The idea that the father is the patriarch would be sitting in the home, you know, waiting to receive possibly the errant son. But, you know, even Jesus' use of the idea that the father ran out to meet him.
He ran. That's exactly right. Yeah. He ran.
And look, and also hearing you talk about confession, I have had, you know, been a committed Catholic for many years, or as some people might say, a Catholic who should be committed. The experience of confession in the last month, for some reason, and it must have been grace, I just felt, you know, I need to make this sacrament a weekly thing, you know. And am I a more heinous sinner than anybody else? Well, that's between me and my confessor. But I was literally blown away when I started to take that sacrament seriously. Like you just said, a whole bunch of things start to happen. One is you start to move into a mindfulness during the week, and specifically on Saturday at 5 p.m., of where your life is. And, you know, we talk of Aristotle saying the unexamined life isn't worth living. So, look, the one things I wanted to do is let's talk a little bit about, you know, your interest in spiritual direction. I've been interested to follow. So, again, for people that have no idea what spiritual direction is, and I'm lucky enough to have somebody I see once a month, tell us about spiritual direction. Why did you get into it? What do you love about it? And what does it allow God to do?
Well, outside of the sacraments and a prayer life, spiritual direction is the most powerful tool for spiritual growth available to a Catholic. And essentially, it's a relationship between three persons. It's the most important person is the Holy Spirit, of course, and the directee, which is the person seeking to know and understand and live out the will of God and know the love of God. And the director is the one who is the guide or the coach or the mentor or whichever analogy works for you that can help you to listen better. Why do we need a director? There are a few reasons. One is the human person has an infinite capacity for self-deception. We have the all of us think we are what we desire to be rather than what we truly are. It's a perennial problem. The second reason is we have blind spots that are there because of our human limitations. So last time you had your brakes out in your car, brake light out in your car, how do you find that out? Well, somebody has to tell you because it's out of your peripheral vision. Well, in the spiritual sense, we have a huge problem because of sin, because of the way we're brought up, because of the lies of the world that we bought into. All of these different reasons, we have the inability to see the very things that hinder us most in our spiritual growth. So spiritual direction is a very powerful means to breaking through those, to expanding our peripheral vision through the open dialogue with another who can see what we can't see, and then helping us to learn to better pray and live a life of virtue and really engage with Christ. It's a very, very powerful practice.
What drew you to it?
What drew me to it is, as a Protestant, we had this idea of discipleship. Outside of the Catholic Church, there's this idea of the responsibility of one Christian to disciple another, which follows the admonition at the end of, I think it's Matthew's gospel, to go out and preach to all the world and make disciples of all nations. In the Catholic Church, we have an even more fully developed idea of how that works. When I heard about it, because I became Catholic, I knew I wanted to grow, give my life to Christ, I thought, well, I need help. As soon as I heard about spiritual direction, I was enamored with the idea. I dug in myself, started a blog about it, which I thought about 8 people might be interested in, because I couldn't find a lot of information out there that wasn't tainted with New Age or non-Christian Eastern mysticism. So I began to write about the richness of the Catholic tradition of spiritual direction, and we now have millions of people that have visited us. 14,000 subscribers who read every email we send, and out of that emerged the book Navigating the Interior Life, which basically helps both priests and religious and lay people, all of these groups, understand what is the rich tradition that they can tap into to experience what you and I both know, which is this wonderful gift of growing in grace in a purposeful way.
So your book, Navigating the Interior Life, and we're going to put a bunch of links underneath the interview here for people to find it. If you had to encapsulate your book in a couple of sentences, tell us about the book.
It would be, it's basically describes what spiritual direction is and isn't, how to find a director, how to engage with a director, and then in the meantime, all of the things that you can do to grow spiritually toward the Lord and to deepen your relationship with the Lord. So it's a book that has essentially 2 fundamental parts, which is spiritual direction, and the second part is the journey to God, which is understanding how to deepen your life in prayer and in relationship to Christ.
So we'll put all the links under there for people to follow that up. And now what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about Catholic education. I had the pleasure of reading your article recently on National Catholic Register, which was entitled Putting Catholic Back into Education. And you talk about some great stuff there, and I think really what you're doing in the article is you're talking about a couple of things. One is you're stating the obvious that if a Catholic school has the name Catholic, then here's a crazy idea. How about it becomes or tries to become actually Catholic? And that's a pretty outrageous idea, because I've worked with schools over the years that have all sorts of interesting ideas about why they exist, and I'm not being flippant there. Many of our educators do fantastic work. But I'm reminded of a quote from Richard John Newhouse, who's passed away, as you're probably aware, and was the editor of First Things, and he had a wonderful turn of phrase, and he was talking about a statement from a large group of American religious who had developed a big policy document on recycling plastic bottles. And now I'm going to turn some people off. I'm not. The church has a wonderful developed doctrine on the environment, and I can refer people to that. But his comment was, you know, I guess this is what you do when you've forgotten the reason that you were actually constituted. And it was basically saying, you know, let's get back to basics. The environment's a really important issue, and especially as the new Pope mentions, but there are some fundamentals that are really crucial to Catholic education. So you talk about Bishop Robert Vassa, who's in Santa Rosa, California, he's asked staff to sign an addendum to their employment contracts, which is pretty direct, and it's asking them to uphold key teachings. And you also talk about the Archbishop from Kansas City, who's really put the money where it needs to be and developed a school of faith for teachers. So let's talk about those things. Let's talk about Catholic schools. What's happening? What's good? What needs to change?
Well, I mean, you've hit the center of the piece, which I was trying to draw. My wife, by the way, is a Catholic school principal, and she regularly encounters this interesting response to her bringing in, for instance, the Angelus or Mass, regular Mass attendance and teaching kids about sin and redemption. And she's regularly confronted with, what are you doing? Which both of us are often just flabbergasted at. Catholicism and maybe even Christianity, and maybe, you know, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but it seems very American that people just want to decide what it is and what it isn't. And I don't know if you can imagine, you know, here we play baseball as one of our most popular sports, or football, but let's use baseball as an analogy. What would happen if the catcher decided one day that instead of being behind the batter, he was going to be in front of the batter? Well, he would be thrown out of the game, and everybody would say, well, of course he should be thrown out of the game because he's not following the rules. And if we don't all have this sensible interplay between us, whereby we're doing and operating and acting in keeping with the central purpose of what this thing is about, which we call baseball, or this game of baseball, if you violate those fundamental principles, then you disrupt and destroy the whole game. And everybody, of course, would say, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that. You'd have the biggest uproar and news event that you could ever imagine if somebody did that in the major leagues in the USA. Why is it that in Catholic education that somehow people think that we get to redefine all of the rules and it's okay? It's frankly baffling to me. And I'm grateful that these bishops, Archbishop Naumann and Bishop Robert Vassa, have said, look, if we're going to play this game, this is called Catholicism. this is about Christ and his church. Yeah. And if we're going to do this, we're going to have integrity, Jonathan. Yeah. Integrity. We're going to be we're going to be people who are not lacking in integrity. We're going to be people who are faithful, who are consistent with what we claim to be, and we're going to teach our children in that manner. How outrageous is that? It's not. It's what's outrageous is that people would somehow think, you know, that, you know, Jonathan, words are almost beyond me on this subject. Yeah. With respect to Catholicism. I don't use the term liberal or conservative with respect to Catholics. I use the term faithful or unfaithful. Yeah. You either submit to the magisterium of the church and follow the teachings of Christ and what the church says it is, thereby defines what it is and defines what you are if you claim to be Catholic, or you're unfaithful, meaning you're the catcher moving out in front of the batter, and it would be a sin for a bishop to allow something other than what Bishop Vassa has done and Archbishop Naumann to allow the game to continue to go on, because, you know, people have totally disrupted it. So I don't know, Jonathan, it's crazy.
It's great to see that level of courage and leadership, and, you know, we see it from guys like Archbishop Chaput, and there's some great bishops, and there's great stuff happening. And I think going to the very core of it, and again, Robert Barron picked this up in the Catholicism series, and I guess I got this out of my formation at the Pontifical Institute, is right at the very heart of this is another kind of hidden tension. And what we see, I think, what I see working with teachers in schools is we see the surface tension. We see the, you can't tell me this, and this is outrageous, and the church is killing everybody in Africa. But underneath it all is this fundamental question about, I guess, the idea that the church is a voting entity, which...
Right.
And Barron picks this up. It's sort of like in liberal democracies, which are, you know, as Churchill kind of said, you know, it's the best worst system. You know, it's not perfect, but it's better than anything else.
Right.
We have this idea that we vote in and we vote out, and that the will of the people does X. And it's a great system for, I guess, what Augustine would call the city of man. But what Barron gets to is that this is the church established by Christ. And he didn't say, you know, on this rock I will build a voting entity which will meet once a week. And it's fascinating, isn't it? And I think it causes great scandal to people. They can't seem to get past this idea that what I'm trying to say to them, and not to be triumphalistic and not to be rigidly dogmatic, but to say to them, look, the church is not like anything else, you know. It's not like your government. It's not like what you voted for. It is the bride of Christ, and it's a fundamentally different thing. And maybe that's the first question that maybe is not being discussed enough. I'm not sure.
Well, it's back to what we talked about before. Is the church a means through which we have a relationship with Christ? Is God really alive? Or is this a social institution, a construct of man, whereby it's governed most appropriately by the lowest common denominator, or the highest number of votes for whatever idea? Well, as you and I know, if you know Christ if you're in a living relationship with Christ, you understand that the Holy Spirit has never fallen asleep on the job, that he's leading this institution on behalf of the Trinity to help us understand and know how to love him and live out our lives. If you get that, then it's much easier to understand why a Catholic school exists. The Catholic school exists to introduce children to Christ and to equip them to live out their life in Christ effectively. Mm. So now let me back up. I've just talked about the absurdity. Here's the problem. Most teachers have not been afforded even the most basic expression of the gospel in a way that they can understand it, like we've been talking about here today. Yeah. Most teachers have never heard, you can know Christ, and he's waiting for you to delve into a deeper relationship with you. So that when they see it as a social institution, it's because of our failure, or the failure of those who taught them, to help them enter into the most important aspect of this reality, this mystery, so that when they begin to live it out, they don't live it out in a confused way as if it's a social institution.
Mm. And that's the heart of it. The issue, two things you said. One is that the Catholic school exists to introduce children to Christ. And often what I share in sessions is that the longest study that we've seen here in Australia, and maybe staff could email me if there's been more work done more recently, but we had a 25-year longitudinal study of students leaving Catholic schools in their final year of high school. And it came in at less than 5% of the students leaving our schools essentially set foot inside a church within the 12 months after graduation.
Wow.
And it was just like, and people have, you know, I've had people sort of off the floor saying, well, that's not the only criteria. If I'm going, well, look, the Eucharist for a start is the source and the summit, so we'd want to see
right.
there. But, you know, maybe it's not the only criteria, but, you know, it's a pretty important one. And, I think what you're
doing, that's like saying a steering wheel is not the only criteria for navigating in a car.
It's and the other thing that you've said that's really important, I think, is let's not shoot the messenger. And for Catholic teachers listening to this, never hear me as saying that that you're the source of the problem. I mean, the whole reason we do this is because you are the huge part of the answer. And I think you're right that the level of formation has never been offered, never been provided. Less than 8% of our teachers in this country have any formal theological qualifications. And something you said at the very start, you talked about reading the Church Fathers, and that your encounter with Christ really began, or with the Catholic faith really began, in reading that stuff. And similar for me, studying at the Pontifical Institute, there were moments sitting in an empty room reading a book where the encounter with truth, with the transcendental of truth, you know, blew what was left of my hair back. I was like, wow. And how are we going to do that? So what can we do? Let's get back to practicals. To give our staff, to give teachers, where would they start in this journey of encountering the real church, not the one that's served up to them on the front page of secular papers?
Well, let me use my wife as an example. Every week, as a principal, she provides formation, spiritual formation for her staff. So, for instance, she recently took them through Catholicism project that you've referenced a number of times from Father Barron. She then takes them through book studies on classical Christian spirituality, Catholic spirituality, and really tries to help her teachers engage with Christ in that way. Now, of course, that presupposes the principal has that. If the principal doesn't have that, then we just go back to the question you asked earlier, which is, how do I begin to develop a relationship with Christ? But I think as principals can use that staff development time to dig into the most important aspect of who they are and what they're doing, which is learning to know and love Christ. That, to me, would be the most practical thing they can do. Another thing, interestingly enough, Jonathan, is I haven't announced this publicly, so I'm going to do it on your show, and that is we're starting something called the Avila Institute in September of this year, which will give people certificates in spiritual theology taught by a PhD in spiritual theology out of a pontifical institute in Rome and Franciscan University. And what we're doing is offering that online. Now, of course, I've done webinars and had Aussies join me, and I'm talking at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, and I think that's somewhere around 2 a.m. in your world. But they've joined us nevertheless because they're hungry for that spirituality. But we're going to launch that online for anyone in the world who wants to have access to faithful Catholic spirituality. Folks will be able to find that through the links you provide, but rcspiritualdirection.com. If you sign up there, we'll keep you abreast of it. But you know, if you're a principal or you're a teacher who this resonates with, go dig in yourself and begin to spread it to your other teachers. If you're a teacher, you know, grab Fulfillment of All Desire. Grab my book or Time for God by Father Jacques Philippe and dig in and commit to meeting with another teacher every week and read through chapters of these books. And then you'll catch fire, and you're going to set people on fire around you. And that will begin in a practical way to spread this wonderful reality of what we're all about.
I love that line you just said there, you know, about catching fire. There's that, I never know who this is attributed to, but that great line where it says, you know, set yourself on fire and everybody will come to watch you burn. You know, it's like, yeah, you're right. It doesn't take much, does it? It just takes a tiny group of committed Catholic teachers in a school who, you know, love and serve their colleagues and radiate something and become infectious. And, you know, I want to give people a lot of hope. There's the interviews that we've done in the last few weeks. There's principals out there doing this, and there are awesome schools. And, you know, I often share that when the light of faith almost disappeared after the fall of Rome and all sorts of stuff, there were these tiny communities on places like Lindisfarne and Iona, these little places where the faith, the tiny flickering flame was kept alive. And I think that's what our schools are at the moment, you know. They're the keepers of the flame, and we've got to really get back to basics and grow. Now, to wrap up, Dan, it's Holy Thursday here in Australia. Listeners would be interested to know that I almost missed this interview because I didn't realise we're a day ahead of the US, and I was out on a bike ride this morning at 6 a.m. and I went, hang on, we're a day ahead, that's now. What I want to do is, it's Holy Thursday, we're going to put this out online, it's 9 o'clock here in the morning, we're going to put this out in line in just an hour or so. So I'm going to ask a lot of teachers to download this, they may listen to it today or over Easter. Can you give us some thoughts on this next few days, you know, what's happening in the heart of the church, what's happening in the Passion narratives? Give people something to think about, reflect on, to do, that will enrich these next few days for them?
The thing I would plead with your listeners to do is find a time for silence. sit with the gospel in the passion narrative, read it out loud, and recognize that Christ did that for you. The only other thing I would ask, implore you to do, is get a copy of The Passion of the Christ. And if you've never watched it, watch it. I want to use a term that might be off-putting, but my dad would use it. Don't be a sissy. Don't worry about how it might hurt your feelings or be difficult. But face the cross. And if you face the cross and the great sacrifice that he made for you, you will begin to understand the depths of his love. Because when you realize that your sin is what caused this every lashing and scourging, that your sin, that our sin is what drove the nails into his hands. But even so, even knowing that we would do that to him, he brought us into existence to be in a love relationship with him. Find some silence to meditate on the Stations of the Cross. Get Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. There's an edited version that's less painful. I actually just wrote a post about this on ncregister.com called Facing the Cross. You can find all the links on that post at ncregister.com. And find a time to just be with the Lord. If it's 10 minutes, if it's 30 minutes, all the better. If it's adoration, even better. Find a church. Just sit by yourself and ask him to reveal his love to you. I promise you that if your heart is open, you'll find it.
Dan, thank you so much. And I want to just... I hope people will have a chance to listen to this and reflect on it. And I want to just, again, direct people to some crucial links. I'll put them under the interview here. But if you're listening, make sure you check out ncregister.com, where Dan writes for National Catholic Register, and do a search for Dan there, and you'll find all his works. I want you to check out Dan's book, Navigating the Interior Life. I really want to support what he's doing, because you know I've got the great benefit of a spiritual director, and I can't encourage people enough to check out that book and to consider finding somebody to walk with him. Also check out Time for God by Jacques Philippe, and I'll find a link for that too. And Dan, it's exciting to hear about the stuff you're doing with the Avila Institute, and I hope people can join the email list and just keep up to date. And the final thing is, what I want to do, I was going to ask you to finish a sentence for me and to see how you go. Finish this sentence for me. The most important thing about being Catholic is...
knowing and loving Christ and loving others out of that love.
Perfect. Perfect answer. Well, Dan Burke, thank you so much for your time. These things just take a tangent, and it has been an absolute pleasure to listen to you. I think I've got buckets more out of it than anyone else. I'm selfish that way. I want to thank you for your faithfulness to the journey that you've taken and the courage you've shown. And I want to thank you for serving the church and for serving us here today. And I reckon we're going to have you back in a few months to go a little bit deeper. But Dan Burke, on behalf of us here at Being Catholic, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure to speak with you as well.
God bless.
God bless you.